pulled by helicopter to Launch Complex 374-6 and got a ride from a security police officer to 4-7, about 10 miles away. Wearing protective gear, they walked down the access road in the dark, carrying alpha, beta, and gamma ray detectors. They went as far as the low hill overlooking the complex, found no evidence of radioactivity, a good sign, and walked back to the access control point near Highway 65. English put on a bunny suit and prepared to search for the warhead. The suit was a lot lighter than the Refco he'd worn to find Livingston. English thought that he'd seen the warhead during one of his trips onto the complex. His second-in-command at disaster preparedness, Sergeant Franklin Moses, and the members of the EOD unit suited up too. The half-dozen members of the initial reconnaissance team, led by English, waited for permission from SAC headquarters to look for the weapon. The word came from Omaha. They could enter the complex at first light. Rodney Holder was still wearing the t-shirt and old pants he'd put on to take a nap just before the klaxon sounded at 4-7. Almost 12 hours had passed since then, and it felt like a long night. Now Holder and Ron Fuller were sitting on the access road to Launch Complex 4-6, outside the town of Republican. They'd hitched a ride from a security police officer at the grocery store in Damascus, hoping to get back to the base in Little Rock. But the officer had gone to 4-6 to pick up a two-man radiation team, and the helicopter had taken off from 4-6 without waiting for Holder and Fuller. The chopper's departure left them with a couple of options. They could return to the scene of the accident with the radiation team, or stay on the access road at 4-6. The security officer lent Holder his coat and drove off. It was still dark, and the two men sat in the road, exhausted, waiting for someone to give them a ride. At the Baptist Medical Center in Little Rock, doctors tried to save the lives of Jeff Kennedy and David Livingston. The two were put into the intensive care unit, placed on ventilators, and given high doses of corticosteroids. Oxidizer released by the blast had induced a dangerous form of respiratory distress. Both of the men were now suffering from pulmonary edema as fluid filled their lungs. Kennedy's wife left their children with a friend and rushed to the hospital. A young woman came to see Livingston as well, telling one doctor that she was his wife, another that she was his sister. Colonel Michael J. Robertson, the chief of aerospace medicine at the base, who'd treated the injured airman aboard the helicopter, didn't care who she was. He was just glad that Livingston had someone there. The worst effects of the oxidizer would usually appear about 5 hours after exposure. Like the phosgene gas used as a chemical weapon during the First World War, the oxidizer could kill you in an extremely unpleasant way. It was known as dry land drowning. Matthew Arnold had been fast asleep when the phone rang at about 3:30 in the morning. The caller told him to report to the base. His EOD unit was heading into the field. The call came at a bad time. Arnold and his wife had just moved into a new apartment in Shreveport, and they'd stayed up late moving boxes. He'd gotten only a few hours of sleep. The place was full of boxes that still needed to be unpacked, and he didn't feel like going to work at 3 a.m. When Arnold arrived at Barksdale, his squadron commander said that they were going to Arkansas, and nothing more. As the unit loaded its gear into a couple of pickup trucks and prepared to leave, Arnold felt guilty about leaving his wife to deal with the mess at home. He wouldn't be able to call her, tell her where he was going, or let her know how long he'd be gone. The EOD team at Barksdale was part of the Strategic Air Command, and it responded to every accident involving SAC nuclear weapons in the eastern half of the United States. During Arnold's 2.5 years as an EOD technician, the unit had spent most of its time on mundane assignments. When unexploded ordnance was found in the marshes surrounding the airbase, his EOD squad would defuse it. Every so often, when a plane crashed, they'd render safe the bombs, starter cartridges, flare packages, rounds of ammunition, and ejection seat rocket motors found in the wreckage. and when nothing else was happening, they'd practice taking apart and reassembling dummy weapons. But on a few occasions, Arnold responded to accidents that involved the real thing. Twice at Barksdale, a load cart collapsed while transporting a rotary launcher full of short-range attack missiles. Each launcher held 6 SRAMs, and the load carts had telescoping arms to lift the missiles into the bomb bay of a B-52. During both accidents, the telescoping arms broke, dropping the rotary launcher and the SRAMs about 5 feet to the ground. At least 2 warheads and 6 missiles were damaged. A manufacturing defect or corrosion seemed the most likely explanation for the collapse of the telescoping arms. But an Air Force investigation later found a different cause. Maintenance crews had been goofing around with the load carts out of sheer boredom and using them to lift B-52 bombers off the ground. In April 1979, Arnold's unit responded to a nuclear weapon accident a few miles north of Fort Worth, Texas. The accident was considered serious enough to require their presence urgently in the middle of the night, and so they flew there in the only aircraft that was available, the base commander's KC-135. The big jet was a lot plusher than the planes that usually carried Arnold's team. At Carswell Air Force Base, someone on a loading crew had ignored a tech order and pulled the handle too hard in the cockpit of a B-52. Instead of opening the bomb bay doors, he'd inadvertently released a B-61 hydrogen bomb. It fell about 7 feet and hit the runway. When members of the loading crew approached the weapon, they saw that its parachute pack had broken off and that a red flag had appeared in a little window on the casing. The bomb was armed. Arnold's team arrived at the base, removed a small panel from the casing, and rotated a switch with a wrench. A green flag replaced the red one in the little window. The bomb was safe. The whole procedure took about an hour, and Arnold's unit flew back to Barksdale on their usual means of air transportation, a cargo plane. The prospect of having to render safe a W-53 warhead didn't make Arnold nervous. The core of the W-53 contained highly enriched uranium, not plutonium, largely eliminating the inhalation hazard and the risk of radioactive contamination. He'd visited Titan II launch complexes, practiced on dummy versions of the weapon, and at Indian Head, he'd been taught that nuclear weapons were almost impossible to detonate accidentally. The safety mechanisms had always worked, even during plane crashes and fires.